things were really swinging for me. I was really happy at this time. And I'd had a burning ambition to play a big bass fiddle to provide good rhythm for the band, I thought. A big bass fiddle would give us a bit, that little extra bit of backing in the rhythm section. So I was in a pub one night. I'd taken the band there to give them a drink, and chap got talking about music and bands. This chap said, I happened to mention I'd like a bass fiddle, and this chap said, oh, I know a chap who's got a big bass fiddle and he wants to sell it. So I said, well, who is he? He said, it was in my regiment, he said, stationed at the prisoner of war camp in Port Mary, Port Erin. So I said, well, next time you see him, ask him how much he wants for it. I said, I'd love one. So next I met this soldier, he said, oh, I was talking to a friend of mine. He said, if you give him a fiver, you could have it. That's £5. So that was dirt cheap, absolutely throwing it away. So I said, oh, that's great. When could I got over, he said, oh, you'll have to pick it up. He's stationed down at Port Erin, you'll have to pick it up. So, Thursday was half day, the shops, the Isle of Man, or it wasn't in those days. I arranged to go down the following Thursday, so I looked around trying to hire a car or a van. Well, taxis were very rare during the war years with the shortage of petrol. But I found a chap who lived in Christian Road. He's one of the very few taxis running around Douglas at that time. An awfully nice chap. He came, one of my best friends ever. Billy Farragher, his name was. He had a bad heart, so he couldn't be called for military service. So he had this taxi running around. So I went to see him and asked him if he would run me down to pick a fiddle up from Port Erin. So he said, oh, certainly. So I arranged for the Thursday afternoon, and Freddie Callow asked if he could come with me. So on the Thursday afternoon, I went to Christian Road and met Billy Farragher. He had an Austin 7, I think it was called, a fawny coloured Austin, a beautiful car, one of the nicest cars I've ever been in my life. It was a beautiful car. So I sat in the front with him, and young Freddie Callow sat in the back seat. So we set off, beautiful sunny day it was, and we were having a bit of a sing-song going down the road, and I was getting to know Billy Farragher quite well, chatting away, different people we knew, and one thing or another, and we were all very pally. Eventually, we got down to Port Erin, and the place was fenced off with barbed wire, with gateways that were guarded. So we pulled up at the gateway. There was a sergeant there and a couple of sentries, so I asked for this soldier by name, so he sent one of these chaps to fetch him. So this lad come, and I said, I've come to get the fiddle. So this lad said, oh, okay. So we went up, and he came back with this bass fiddle, and the sergeant said, what are you doing with that? So he said, I'm selling it to this civilian. So this fellow looked at me, the sergeant, he said, have you got a permit to take this out of the camp? So I said, no. He said, well, you'll have to have a permit. Strict security here, you know. So I said, well, where do I get a permit? So he says, in Douglas Courthouse, you'll have to go up to the police station there. Oh, blimey, I said, just come from there. So we got back in the car and we set off, went back to Douglas singing away. Went to the police station and got a chit to pass arranged for the fiddle to be taken out of the camp. So we set off back down to Port Ayrton, and we got there and gave the chit to the sergeant. Give the £5 to this lad, and the lad gave him the fiddle. So Billy Farragut was looking at me as if I was stupid. So he says, how are we going to get it in the car? He said, when you said a fiddle, he said, I thought you meant a thing you put on your neck and play. I said, oh, that's a violin. So he said, well, I've got no roof rack. So I said, oh, blimey. So by this time, quite a few of the prisoners had gathered along the wire, and these sergeant and these guards were all there having a good laugh at our expense. So I said, oh, wait a minute, let's think. So I opened both the back doors, so I said to Freddie Callow, you get inside there, Freddie. So he sat in the back seat, and I pushed the body of the fiddle in. Said the fella to Fred, now you guide it. So we pushed it right through and out the other side. Then I closed the door on my side, lowered the window. I said, right now, push it back through so the neck of the fiddle comes out through the window. So he done that. Then I shouted to Billy Farragut, now you shut the other door there. So poor Freddie was sitting on the back seat there with this big fiddle right across the front of him. So I was soaked with sweat by this time, and so was Billy Farragut. So I said, oh, I could just go a glass of shandy, couldn't you, Bill? So he said, yeah, okay then. So there was a pub just opposite the gate, so I said, we'll leave the car here for a minute, eh? So we said to Freddie, we'll be back in a minute. So we went off and we had a pint of shandy each. Eventually, after having a good rest, we made our way back to the car with all these prisoners and the guards all still standing there having a good laugh, laughing at poor Freddie with a fiddle stuck across him. So we got into the car and we set off for home. So from Castletown, from Port Ayrton, you have to go through Port St Mary and on through to Castletown. Well, we were coming through Castletown, there was a narrow street. Bill took this turning down called Arbury Street. So it's only room for one car. You have no room for cars to pass. And the little narrow pavements. And we were driving along, not very fast, singing away at the top of our voices. And there was an old man. Well, don't know how old he was, but a bloke with a walker, like a pretty hefty man, walking on this little narrow pavement. As we drew alongside him, I heard a bump. So Billy Farragut put his brakes on and pulled up. Looked out, we couldn't see anything. Got out of the car, and the neck of the fiddle had hit this man at the back of the neck. He was lying on the pavement, groaning. So I looked at him and said, you're all right. Poor Freddie was still stuck in, with the fiddle stuck across him. So this fellow's moaning and groaning. I said, oh. So I said to Billy, oh, pull the car into the square, into the town square, and I'll walk him to the pub. So I walked him, helped this fellow to the George Hotel, which is in the square at Castletown. So Billy parked the car and come across to see how we're getting on. He says, you're not going to die. I said, no. So got him 3 or 4 big double rums. By that time he was recovering and he was all right. So we set off. But I'll never forget that. And we got back to Douglas. And Billy Farragut pulled up outside my sister's house in the main road where I was living then. And helped me out with the fiddle. So he said he would run Freddie Callow home. So I got hold of this big fiddle and walked up, opened the front door and stood in the hall. And Freddie Callow shouted out, what time is the dance start tonight, Arthur? I turned round to speak to him and the neck of the fiddle hit this big mirror in my sister's hallway and smashed the mirror. My sister came out, oh, she was in a shocking temper. She said, get that thing out of here. I'm not having that thing in my house. Get it out of here. So I had to carry it round the back lane and into the backyard and leave the fiddle there. So she wouldn't have it in the house at all. So about a week or so after, it was in like a little shed in the garden, in the backyard. There was a Liverpool lad came to one of the dances and he wasn't playing anything. He was said he had a band back home and he had a played drums and all sorts. He was a bit of a clever chap. So he said, I hear you bought a big bass fiddle. You're not playing it? I said, no. I said, it's a bit of a dead loss to be. Well, he said, I'll buy it off you. Do you want to sell it? So I said, yeah, well, how much will you give it? He said, how much do you want? So it had cost me the taxi. But Bill Farragut, he turned, as I say, he didn't charge me much. And he turned out to be one of the best pals I ever had. So it wasn't much, all that much money. And the rums I had to buy this old fellow. So I said, oh, give me the £5 that I paid for it and I'll be happy. Give me the £5. So he said, oh, okay, you know, when can I get it? So I told him to come up to my house, the Winnie's house, the following day, and I gave it to him. So when he came, he says, I'm sorry, I haven't got the money with me. He said, but we don't get paid till Friday. So he said, I'll see you on Saturday night in the Dog's Home. That's an hotel near Strand Street. So I went there, but he never turned up. And I inquired about him the following week. He'd been posted back to the mainland. He must have known it. So I lost the fiddle and I lost the money. And I was out of pocket. But at least it was a good laugh. We enjoyed it. And my sister at that time, she used to take soldiers lodging with her. And my father was living with her then and he used to help out with the catering for them. And my sister's husband was in the King's Liverpool Regiment then. They were stationed in the Isle of Man. They were guarding prisoners down the south of the island, down at the Port End, the Boston Mary Camp. So their company ran a dance, were holding a dance at the Perwick Bay Hotel in Port St. Mary, just on the outskirts of Port St. Mary, and he asked me if we could play there. So I got another trumpeter and another sax player. That was three saxes and two trumpets. And there was a chap stationed with my brother-in-law at this prison war camp who played the trombone. At one time, he had been a fine musician before the war. And he'd played at the Tower Ballroom in Blackpool with a well-known band in those days, Bertini and his ballroom, Tower Ballroom Orchestra. But this chap was too keen on the drink, he was a drunkard. And he couldn't, never turned up for certain nights and that sort of thing, so he'd got the sack. And he came to the Isle of Man and he played the trombone on the promenade with a hat on the pavement, collecting money up the visitors in the summer season. But he was an exceptionally good musician, so I had the three saxes, two trumpets, and I got him on trombone playing that night. But it was a terrible wet night, and this friend of mine I mentioned just a short while ago, Bruce Brydson, who worked in the government office, he was only, I think he was 16 at the time. He asked if I would take him at the band. So we had to have two taxis that night, Billy Farragut's and another one, and we set off. Well, we were very successful. We played there a couple of times afterwards, and we used to get billed then as the favourites of the South, the Southern Serenaders. But on this occasion, when Bruce came with me, when the dance was finished, we pile the instruments into the taxis, and I shouted, is everyone here? Everybody in? Everybody all? Yes, yes. We piled in the taxis and we set off home. Next day I went round to Bryden's house in Brunswick Road, and his mother, she nearly hit me with a pen. She, "The hell do you think you were doing last night?" I said, "What are you talking about?" We'd forgotten Bruce in Port St. Mary, and he walked home the whole distance. He only got home about 7 o'clock in the morning. It was a wet night and he had no raincoat and his best suit on. Oh, I was afraid to go back to that house for quite a while. Poor lad, he'd walked all the way home. And it was blackout, no lights. And it would be, what is it, about 11 or 12 mile. So I wasn't too popular with Mrs. Bryden on that occasion. But all this time, during this time I'm talking about, I was getting letters from Joyce and writing to her, telling her we were going on. And she was really thrilled with it, to know that things were going so well. And she sent me a photograph. I'd asked her to send me a photograph, and she sent me one. It was a full-length studio portrait. And at the bottom in the corner, she'd written, "With all the love you once had for me, Joe." God, how happy that made me. I was as pleased as punch. She told me she loved me again. So I was determined more and more to get on. But we got quite a few good engagements with that band, and sometimes there'd be six of us, sometimes I had as many as nine playing. But the Rhythm Boys, Arthur Adams and his Rhythm Boys, were on the way up. But I felt I wanted to get in the big time, playing on the mainland, getting them broadcast on the radio. Then he used to say, "I must try and get going." Then he used to say to me, "Oh, the trouble with you," he says, "you're too ambitious. Let's get a chance to play at the Villa Marina first." I said, "No, we get a chance in England, we'll do good. There's more scope there. All we need is a chance." Anyway, this week I looked in the Melody Maker, which was the musical paper then, much as it is. I think it's still going today, but I used to get that every week. I saw an advert in Wanted Ballroom Manager, the Rialto Ballroom, Liverpool. So I said, "I'm going to answer it. I'm going to write away." I said, "If I get that job then," I said, "I'll be able to put my own band in there, get a band together and start on the big time." I said, "If I get it, would you come over and play with me?" Well, he's very dubious, you know, but anyway, I answered the advert and I gave as much detail as to experience in organising army shows and all that sort of thing I'd been in. I never mentioned it to Joyce, in case nothing came of it. But I felt that if I did get it, you know, she'd be quite pleased, and Liverpool's not far from Southport. I'd never had, well, I had an odd drink, but nothing much. And I was feeling on top of the world. And the days came and went. I was enjoying playing at night. As I say, I kept buying more and more modern orchestrations, especially Harry Roy's. And I should try and give impressions of Harry Roy when I was doing the vocals. And Bing Crosby too. I used to play all Bing's numbers at the time. At that time, the Germans, the Nazis, were bombing Liverpool quite regular. In one of her letters, Joyce told me how, when they received a warning, they carried the children down to the shelter and sat there singing for them and telling them stories until the all clear went. She said that they only got the warnings as the planes made their way over that district on the way to the big towns and cities, and not to worry, as Birkdale was not a military target and no bombs had ever been dropped there. Every night as I lay in bed, I wondered how she was and prayed for her safety. Anyway, a few weeks later, I got home and found a letter waiting for me. It was a reply to the application for the position at the Rialto Ballroom. Said, "Dear Mr. Adams, in reply to your application for the position of ballroom manager, I will be pleased to give you an interview. When would it be convenient for you to cross to the mainland? Awaiting your reply, I remain yours sincerely." Signed by the district superintendent of the Government British Film Corporation, who owned the ballroom. I was thrilled. I waited until I'd showed it to Len, and everything was going all right. We'd been booked for the post office staff dance dinner to be held in Collinson's Cafe, Duke Street, on the 29th of April, which was an important annual event, and at which the Palady Dance Band usually had the honour of playing. Anyway, I went and seen Len and told him I'd got the letter, and he was still cautious. "Don't count your chickens before they hatched, Arthur," he said. "You still have to have the interview. You might not get it." He was always the cautious one, you know. I said, "Don't talk like that, Len. Leave it to me. I'll get the job. I just got to, you know. You know how much it means to me. Anyway, I'm going to cross over on Monday. I'll fix the interview for Thursday. I'm going to write to Joyce and ask her if she will see me and talk to me again. She gets every Wednesday afternoon off duty, so I'm hoping that she'll meet me and have a good talk. I want to tell her the news then. I'm keeping her for a surprise." So that's what I done. That night I wrote the two letters, one making the appointment for the interview and the other to ask Joyce if she would meet me on the Wednesday. It'd be wonderful to see her again. It was nearly a year since we had last been together. I got applied for leave from the post office and it was granted, and on the Monday I set off on my way to Liverpool. I went and stayed with my cousins in Port Sunlight. I'd given my cousin's address in Port Sunlight on both the letters, the one asking for the interview and the other to Joyce, so I waited there till I got a reply. Day after I got there, on the Tuesday, I had the letter from the Rialto to say that the superintendent was out of town for a few days, and they'd made an appointment for 10 a.m. on the Thursday morning. Well, by Tuesday evening, there was still no word from Joyce, and I thought it must be that although she'd forgiven me as far as corresponding was concerned, she didn't want to see me in person. So I went to bed feeling pretty miserable. Next morning I got up and still feeling miserable. Anyway, a knock came on the door, and my cousin went to come back saying, "Here's a letter for you, Arthur." So I jumped up and crossed my fingers and then tore it open. I read it. "Dear Bing, I will be able to see you on Wednesday afternoon. Will you meet me outside the post office at 2:30? I'm looking forward to seeing you again. I hope it is a fine day and Jerry doesn't visit us. Until Wednesday, so long, I'll be seeing you, Joe. I rushed and got me coat and hat and shouted to my cousin, she's going to see me today. I won't be too late, but I'll be later than usual, you know, so don't worry about me. I got into my jacket and rushed out of the house. I crossed on the Mersey ferry and made my way up to Exchange Station in Liverpool, and I caught the train to Southport there. Once I was got seated in the train, I took the letter out and read it over and over. Then I realised in it she had not stated which post office she would meet me, Birkdale or Southport. It had me puzzled, and after long thinking, I decided to chance Birkdale. It was only 10:30 a.m. when the train arrived at the small station of Birkdale, which is only a short distance from Southport. Oh, I asked the station master the direction of the post office. It only took a few minutes to find the place, but when I seen it, I felt certain it wouldn't be the one where she would choose as a meeting place. It was only a counter in a small shop, like a little sub-post office. So I realised then it must have been the head post office in Southport she had meant. So I caught a bus into the town. When I got off the bus, I had a walk around the town and had lunch at a cafe. About 2:15, I went and stood outside Southport General Post Office in Lord Street. It was a beautiful, gorgeous sunny afternoon with a bit of a breeze blowing in from the sea. The streets were thronged with people dashing to and fro. I walked up and down the pavement wondering how she would be dressed, how would she look, and wondering what to say first. It had been so long and so much had happened since that last night together. Although it wasn't quite a year before, it seemed like a century. 2:30 came and no signs of Joyce. 2:45 and still no Joyce. Had something happened to prevent her coming? Had she changed her mind on the last minute? Well, I made up my mind I'd wait all afternoon if necessary. The clock in a nearby steeple had just struck 3 when a voice behind me said, "Hello." I turned round and there she stood before me. She'd kept her promise. I couldn't speak, I could only stare. She looked different somehow. I tried to make out in which way. She looked paler. She looked older, more mature, but more beautiful than ever. Much more beautiful. Yet there was something about her that was difficult to... I couldn't make out what it was, how she looked so different. I didn't realise up till later that it was her hair. Anyway, the silence, I broke the silence. Joyce said, "Have you been waiting long? I'm sorry I'm late, but I didn't get away from the home until 2:30. I still stared and I said, "Oh no, no, I haven't been here long. I hardly recognise you, Joe. You seem to have changed in some way. I can't explain how." She smiled, she said, "It must be because I've had my hair cut short." "I don't think you've ever seen me with a hat before." She had a hat on. I laughed. "That's what it must be. Where will we go?" "I'm afraid you'll have to show me around today, Joe. I've never been here before." So we walked on down Lord Street, Southport, its main boulevard, and came to the seafront where we sat on a seat. Once we got seated, I turned to her and said, "How are you keeping, Joe? I've been worried beyond words about you since you've been over here. Are you happy? Have you really forgiven me? I know I don't deserve it." Joyce looked into my eyes and she replied, "I've tried hard, Bing, to forget you, to forget I ever met you, and all between us. And yet every night I dream of the happy times we had in that summer. Remember? Several people told me to find someone else, but it's no use. It's always you, Bing." I held her hand. I said, "It's wonderful to hear you say that, Joe. Really, I don't deserve it. You're far too good for me. I've changed now, Joyce. I'm getting on nicely with the band. Lenny is a wonderful chap and a grand pal. With you and him beside me, I can't go wrong. I'll never let you down again. Our luck is changing now. The reason I'm on the mainland this week is for an interview at the Rialto Ballroom, Liverpool." Joyce was got surprised. She said, "Gosh, Bing, is that true? You're not kidding me, are you? How? When? Why didn't you tell me?" I laughed. I said, "I wanted to be a surprise. I found the advert in the Melody Maker about a month ago for a ballroom manager, so I answered it. I just got the reply yesterday to say that I'm having an interview on Thursday." She said, "Oh, that's wonderful. I knew you would get a big chance someday. You've tried hard and you deserve the lucky break. But what about Len and the band?" I said, "Oh, I wouldn't forget them, Joyce. I know they're wanting a new band at the Rialto. I've read that in the papers. If I get the job as manager, I'll have Len and the boys over inside a month. Wouldn't it be great playing in Liverpool, eh? I'd be so much closer to you too. I could slip up here and see you often. I'd be as happy as a king. Tell me please, Joe, are you sure that you are happy?" She looked up, her cheeks seemed to tinge with crimson, and she spoke in a voice that halted. "Yes, yes, Bing, I am all right." I could tell she wasn't telling the truth. "Are you positive, Joe? Something tells me you're homesick." She started to cry. She says, "It's no use pretending, Bing. I am longing for home badly. It will be a few months more before I get my holidays too. You were right when you told me what seems like years ago what it's like to be away from home. I have a cry every night when I'm alone in my bed. I long to see little Dorothy again. How is she? Do you ever see her, Bing? Oh, I miss her childish chatter. I suppose she will have grown a lot by the time I see her again." I felt sorry for her and said, "Why don't you tell your mother you aren't feeling too well and ask her if you can go home for a week? You could go across with me on Saturday. I'd come back with you. It would do you good, buck you up, and bring back your old colour." She says, "No, Bing, I couldn't do that. I wanted so much to be a nurse, as you know. I took the chance when the opportunity came. I've got to see it through no matter what may come or how I feel. It's a big job. Nurses are needed in great numbers. I must carry on until the end of the war anyway. I'm sorry, Arthur, much as I'd like to go home for a rest. My work comes first. I'm needed here. The children at the home must be looked after. You ought to see them, Bing. Such lovely little kids. Strong, healthy young children. To look at them, you wouldn't think there was anything wrong with them. They seem so happy and gay, and yet every one of them is blind. Most of them have been that way, even from birth. They've never seen the sky, the sun and the moon, or the sea, the green fields and the flowers. All they've known is this world of darkness. We have to do all we can for them, Bing. And we can never do enough to bring a little sunshine into their world of darkness. That's why I must stay. I was so impressed by the words that she'd just spoken, and I felt really proud of her, more proud than ever before. "I understand you," I said. "I feel awfully proud of you and the way you're carrying on. I'm sure that all the children must love you. I wish I could go and see them. I'd tell them what a wonderful nurse they had looking after them." She stood up and smiled and said, "Come on, Arthur. Don't pull my leg anymore. Let's walk along the promenade." So I stood up and took her arm and I said, "I'm not kidding, Joe. I really mean it." We set off walking along the seafront, arm in arm, and the wind started blowing quite strong and blowing through our hair as we walked along. We walked right along the promenade and back, after which we went to a Boots's Cafe on Lord Street for tea. It was a beautiful cafe, and the music was provided, and a little orchestra was playing One Day When We Were Young as we walked in. She looked at me and smiled. She said, "That's our tune, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah." Over a cup of tea, we made a decision to go to the cinema. We couldn't make our minds up as which picture we would care to go and see. When tea was finished, we made our way to a cinema. There was a show called Hullabaloo on. It was a pretty crummy picture. In fact, it wasn't worth mentioning, save for a song that came at the end of the film. It was a pleasing song, which we both liked very much. Joyce asked me if I'd get the music and if I'd play it with the band, especially for her. And the words of the song was, "We've come a long way together since we met on the old village green. We've battled all kinds of weather, and to me, you are still sweet 16. Why care if our hair turns to silver? We still have love to keep our hearts aglow. We've come a long way together, and we still have a long way to go." Quite a nice song, and quite a nice melody to it. When we left the cinema, it was starting to grow dusk, and we walked along the seafront from Southport to Birkdale. We walked it. At last, we came to the Sunshine Home, which was on the corner of Oxford Road, overlooking the sea. The red fading sunlight cast a crimson glow over the water, and the cool of the evening was filled with the scent of flowers from the surrounding gardens. It was beautiful, absolutely beautiful. We stood at the gates of the home, and we heard the music from a radio in the building next door. And it was playing, "When day is done and shadows fall, I dream of you. When day is done and grass is wet with twilight dew, that yearning returning to hold you in my arms won't go, love. I know, love, without you life has lost its charms. When day is done and grass is wet with twilight's dew, my only heart remembers all the joys we knew. Although I miss your goodnight kiss the whole day through, I miss you most of all when day is done." Oh, that tune that Joyce told me so long ago was her favourite. It was, seemed to have been all arranged, like in the movies. But it was just on a radio from the place next door. Oh, it was marvellous standing there with her. I put my arms around her and she whispered, "Bing, if you manage to come out on top tomorrow at the interview, you want to stay at the Rialto for a year or so. Build up and prepare for bigger things. Get right up to the top." She said, "You go to this ballroom and work in there," she said, you'll meet lots of women, lots of girls and singers and actresses. I bet you'll forget all about me then." I said to her, "Forget you, Joe? Never. Even if I met Venus de Milo, and even if she had arms on, don't worry, Joyce. I want to go to the top, but I want you to be with me. I want to give you everything you want. I just want to make you happy. And when you are, then I'll be satisfied." She held me close with her arms wrapped around me. She said, "In a couple of years' time, I'll be old enough to marry. If you felt the same way about me then as you do now, would you? Would you ask me to marry you?" I said, "Blimey, that's the queerest thing to ask, Joyce. Would I? Of course I would. I'll never want anybody else but you, Joyce." I held her close and gave her a big, long, lingering kiss. Then she said, "I'd better get in, Bing. It's nearly 10 o'clock. Best of luck tomorrow. Keep your fingers crossed. And thanks a million for the happiest day of my life. Let me know how you get on as soon as you can." I still held her hand and I asked her, "If I slip up on Friday evening, could you manage to slip out for just a minute or two? I'd like to tell you the results personally. Make it 6:30 at the end of this road by the shore." She said, "Okay, I won't be able to be with you for long though. I'll just be able to say I'm going out to post a letter, so I can't stay long. You understand that, don't you?" I said, "That'll be fine, Joyce. You'd better run then." So I said, "So long, I'll be seeing you," and blew her a kiss as she ran up the path. I stood there and watched her until she vanished from my view. Oh, I'd set off for the station and caught the train back to Liverpool. Kept me fingers crossed tomorrow. I've got to make good tomorrow. Next morning, I arrived at the office of the Rialto, quarter of an hour before the appointed time. It pays to be early for an interview. An old saying, there are three things which never return: the spent arrow, the spoken word, and the lost opportunity. Always remember that. So at 10 o'clock, I was there when the superintendent arrived and he asked me to follow him into his private office. He was a middle-aged man, quite good-looking, real businessman. He sat down behind the desk and he asked me to be seated facing him. When I was seated, he offered me a cigarette, which I turned down. I didn't smoke then. Then he picked up a sheaf of papers, which included my application and testimonials. He glanced through the paper and he looked up and said, "Well, young man, I see that you are free from further military service. And I see that you had a bit of experience in organising shows and dances. Have you ever had a manager's situation?" So I said, "No, sir, but I've studied bookkeeping and typing at night school for 2 years. And since leaving school, I've been working at the post office in a clerical situation. But the work doesn't appeal to me." So he leaned over the desk and he said, "It's a big help, a knowledge of bookkeeping and typing. It's a steady job in the civil service. You are sure of your money every week and then at 60 you get a good pension. It's a job to study. Have you thought of that?" "Yes, sir," I said. "And I've thought it over and over, but it's no use. My heart is in the entertainment world." The chap sat, leaned back in his chair a bit. He said, "It's a hard life, you know. You may be in work for 6 months of the year, and the other 6 months doing nothing. You have to work all nights and afternoons When other people are enjoying themselves, you're working. Then you have no real home. You are constantly on the move from one town to another, and you never have what one calls real friends, for as you meet people, you just get to know them. Your work carries you away to some other town before you meet new faces, and so it goes on. Have you ever thought of that? Yes, sir, I said. I thought of all that. I know of its drawbacks and its faults, yet I feel that it's there I belong. The chap smiled and said, you are keen. You're only young, still I like you and your spirit. I'll give you a chance. I'll give you a week to think it over and fix things up at home. Report to me here again a week on Monday. So I stood up, his face in front of me there with a big smile, as I said, thank you, sir. He said, I'm sure. I said to him, I'm sure I won't let you down. I could hardly speak. My mind is made up now, and I'll take your kind offer. The superintendent then stood up and he offered his hand. Very good, son, he said. I'll hear from you Monday week. Good morning. I shook his hand and then said, good morning to you, sir, and once again, many thanks. As I left the building, I felt as if I was walking on air. I went down the street whistling, I'm sitting on top of the world. I'll prove it to Joyce and Len now, that given the opportunity, I'll grasp it. How pleased they'd both be, eh? Friday afternoon, I once set off for Birkdale. I arrived there just in time to have some tea and a little cafe before setting off to meet Joyce. Take me time, I had plenty of time to spare. I strolled down the big long avenue to the place where we'd arranged to meet. The road was bordered on each side with large houses, surrounded by big gardens and magnificent trees in them. And the trees bowed across the road. It was just 6:30 as I arrived at the seafront corner.